During this portion of Bulls basketball, John Paxson was not afraid to wheel and deal in the trade market, especially during his first three off seasons at the helm. In December 2003, the team was off to a 4-12 start when Paxson decided to shift toward the future. His first major trade sent Jalen Rose, Danielle Marshall, and Lonnie Baxter to the Toronto Raptors for a package including veteran forwards Antonio Davis, Jerome Williams, and Chris Jeffries. After the 2004 draft, the Bulls were starting to establish a solid young foundation, so Paxson made two trades to bring in veterans that could complement his young core. The team traded Jamal Crawford to the New York Knicks in a deal that brought back Dikembe Mutombo and Othella Harrington. Mutombo was traded a month later to the Houston Rockets for a package featuring Eric Piakowski and Adrian Griffin. While both were solid trades to add veteran leadership, Paxson's biggest trade would come the following year. After reaching an impasse with center Eddie Curry over his heart condition, the Bulls decided to deal Curry and Antonio Davis to the Knicks in October 2005. While the trade brought back three players, it most notably netted the Bulls a future first-round pick in 2006 and the right to swap first-rounders in 2007. The Knicks finished in the lottery both years, and the Bulls came out with the second overall pick in 2006 and the ninth overall selection in 2007. While Tyrus Thomas might have been a questionable choice for the Bulls in 2006, choosing Joakim Noah in 2007 was a home run decision, especially when you factor in how Curry's career flamed out. However, as this period moved on, there were some decisions that raised eyebrows. After signing Ben Wallace and drafting Tyrus Thomas in the summer of 2006, Paxson decided to pull the plug on the Tyson Chandler experiment, sending him to the New Orleans Hornets in exchange for veteran forward PJ Brown and J.R. Smith. Just days later, he traded Smith to the Denver Nuggets for Howard Eisley and two future second-round picks. Now, trading Chandler did make sense at the time, given the logjam of minutes in the frontcourt and Chandler's unhappiness with playing time from the previous season. However, he flourished into a solid center, becoming a reliable defender and pick-and-roll man. Meanwhile, Wallace regressed within a year and a half, and Thomas never really reached his ceiling with the Bulls. Still, trading Chandler might have been palatable had the Bulls kept J.R. Smith. The then unknown guard blossomed into a reliable role player, capable of scoring in bunches, especially from beyond the arc. The Bulls also might have had chances to trade for bona fide all-stars. They reportedly were in the mix for forwards Kevin Garnett and Pau Gasol. During the 2007 offseason, Kobe Bryant famously lobbied publicly for the Lakers to trade him to Chicago. Now, was the interest serious or just a leverage play? We'll never know. What we do know is that the team was consistently reluctant to part with foundational pieces like Lou Aldang and Ben Gordon. While both were talented core pieces, they weren't established all-stars, and they seemingly hit their ceilings in a hurry, halting the Bulls' pursuit for a title. But when you remove what might have been from the discussion, it's safe to say that Paxson fared pretty well when making trades in this period. Okay, so I feel the two biggest trades Paxson made in this period were with the New York Knicks. The first in 2004 with Jamal Crawford, and the second in 2005 with Eddie Curry. The Crawford trade, of course, netted them key veterans like Othella Harrington, and then Eric Piakowski and Adrian Griffin once they flipped Dikembe Mutombo to a trade in Houston. The Curry trade was notable because it got them a future first-round pick in 2006, which ended up being the number two overall pick. And they also got the rights to swap first-round picks in 2007, which was sort of unheard of at the time. That got them the number nine overall pick, which ended up being Joakim Noah. So, Mark, I'll start with you. Is it safe to say Paxson owned the Knicks in both the Jamal Crawford and Eddie Curry trades?
100%. I mean, if we think about this era of the Baby Bulls era and what it potentially could have been, I think that whole what-if situation is sort of hinged on that Knicks trade, and Paxson completely dominated the Knicks in that trade. And maybe some fans will disagree with me, but I think this is probably Paxson's best move as an executive. Some may point to the Jimmy Butler trade and the fact that they got back Larry Markin and Chris Dunn and Zach LaVine and what those players are to the team right now, what they potentially could be. But obviously the Bulls gave up Jimmy Butler in that situation, whereas in this case, the Bulls weren't necessarily giving up players that they actually valued or necessarily even wanted. Like, it didn't seem like the Bulls even wanted Eddie Curry at that point. So to trade him off to the Knicks and to get back the return they did, which ultimately proved favorable, given the picks that they turned into being. Obviously, Tyrus Thomas and Joakim Noah, we can sub out Tyrus and potentially could have been LaMarcus Aldridge as much as we like. But still, that trade was a damn haul, even based on what Joakim Noah became for this franchise. So yes, Paxton completely dominated the Knicks in both trades. And In a large part, I look back on this era fondly because of those trades, and it's always nice to crush the Knicks, be it on the court or off the court.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, only in that I don't think the Jamal Crawford trade was meaningful at all. You know, we traded away a guy on a sign-and-trade deal that we clearly weren't going to keep anyway, and we got back a couple of veterans who were, you know, kind of okay, but I don't. Like, I don't know if they moved the needle in a particularly large way. Maybe they helped set the culture, but I don't know if that they're so much better than the guys we could have gotten the margins through free agency had we gone that route instead. So that trade to me was like nothing special. The only thing that ended up being good from the Bulls' perspective about it is really Jamal Crawford just ended up as a bad contract. So it was just funny to laugh at the Knicks for paying him so much money. He then later became a good contract after that, which is even funnier that he became a great player as soon as he left the Knicks. The Curry trade definitely was one of the best trades of the Bulls franchise history. You know, so clearly they own the Knicks for that trade. It was one of the best ones. I will disagree a little bit with you, Mark, and that the Bulls didn't want Curry anyway. And maybe this was just because you weren't local, but I mean, there was interviews with Paxton on the radio, and it sounded like he was like going to cry about giving up Eddie Curry. He's like, and I forget the exact quote, but it was like something like, you know, I know what I've done here. He was basically like apologizing to the fan base for trading away Eddie Curry. So he definitely really wanted him. If you don't remember, Eddie Curry had this heart condition, and the Bulls doctor said he should never play again. And then Eddie Curry's doctor said it was fine, and then the Bulls said they didn't want to take the medical risk on him, and that's why they traded him. But he wanted to keep him at the time and traded him because of that. And I think that reason of like feeling like he wanted to keep him was why he got so much value from the Knicks, because he really did value him. And I think that's why the return ended up being as crazy as it was.
Remember, Jerry Reinsdorf and John Paxson both were trying to convince him to take a DNA test to see if it was a genetic condition. And one of the reasons was they wanted to pay him an annuity to retire. So basically, they were willing to just pay him to never play basketball again. So I think it might have been just a personal relationship that they had with Eddie Curry that, you know, made that a hard move for them to make. I actually want to follow up with one quick thing. I wasn't planning on asking this, but if Eddie Curry had stayed, do you think his career would have been any different? Do you think he would have had a positive or negative impact on the Bulls? And I'll start with you, Mark.
No, I mean, his career wouldn't have changed, I don't think. And look, I made this comment about Tyrus Thomas, but I think it all ultimately comes down to mentality and maturity of a player. I think that in large part ultimately defines where a player's career sort of projects to be. I mean, in terms of at least them reaching their projected ceiling. But I mean, Curry just never had that mentality. Same thing with Tyrus. So had he stayed and had he been healthy, I don't think it turned into anything differently.
I agree with Mark. I don't think anything would have changed. He clearly had the heart problem because he was taking tons of weight loss pills to try and get in shape for that 1 year. And after he got paid, he just ate his way out of the league. So I think that was just he did interviews later. He clearly wasn't that big into basketball. He was kind of doing it because he was 7 feet tall. We talked a little bit before the show about how I live near Schaumburg. All you need to know about Eddie Curry, if you've ever been to Schaumburg, is the Schaumburg High School team beat his team in the state championship.
Yep.
And if you live near Schaumburg, you'll know why that's kind of funny in retrospect. So I don't think he was someone who just really had his heart in it. I think it was something where the NBA found him because of his physical traits, not because he was someone who really wanted to do that grind.
So I really quickly want to talk about some of the missed trade opportunities. I know we talked about it a little bit with free agency too. And I feel like I would be remiss not to bring back the whole Kobe Bryant discussion, because that was a big storyline in the summer of 2007, because he was lobbying at the time. It did seem like a leverage play from his part. I want to ask Mark, not so much in terms of whether or not it would have happened, but do you think that the Bulls were actually that interested or just taking the temperature of the situation the whole time?
I mean, it's hard to know because there's so many varying and conflicting reports depending on which report you listen to, whether it's coming out of the Bulls and their sources, whether it's coming out of the Lakers and their sources, and you can do the same thing with Pau Gasol as well, whether you listen to the Bulls sources, whether you listen to Grizzly sources, whoever they may be, on record or off record, whatever they may be. So it's that whole conflation of the issue makes it hard to sort of pass, and I think depending on what you listen to will ultimately shape what your contention is around this situation. But I don't think the Bulls were interested in getting a player. They were definitely interested in bringing Kobe Bryant in, but maybe the price that would have cost them to do so, they clearly weren't interested in. I mean, a key piece in that was Lowell Deng, and obviously based on who Deng was or who they thought he would be. And I think we have to remind ourselves that Deng came into the league pretty young. I think at 21, he was putting up basically 21-9 off the top of my head, or 21-7 or whatever it was. Maybe it was 19-7. Whatever it was, the numbers were pretty damn good for a 21-year-old small forward. We thought he was going to be something special. Maybe not something special, but at least something pretty damn good. So it's an interesting conversation. It's one that ultimately goes back to how each person feels about a particular player, whether you were high on Deng, whether you weren't. Maybe not just Deng specifically, but Bryant too, whether you're of a high opinion of Bryant and whether you weren't. Obviously, that's a pretty mixed conversation as well. So I would say the Bulls were interested in Kobe, but maybe not interested in Kobe to the point where they would have had to have given up what they ultimately would have needed to have got a deal over the line.
Yeah, I think when you look back at this era and you look at the guys who were associated with them, and there was this feeling that the Bulls should consolidate and trade for a star, and the pieces they would have had to consolidate were the ones they needed to be there with that star if they were able to do it. And I think it was just one of those things where, you know, people were thinking, why don't you just swing Chris Duhon, Andres Nocioni, and maybe Ben Gordon, and then get back Kobe Bryant? And that type of thing was just never remotely on the table. Kobe was demanding out of LA at the time because they had no talent with him. And if you traded everything it took to bring him in, you'd have no talent here either. The same was true with Kevin Garnett. So I think it was just one of those things where the amount of pieces it was required to get a deal done was too much, that after you did the deal, you'd really be meaningfully better positioned. And I think with hindsight, it's even more clear when you see where all those players ended up, that if you traded away half of the roster to get a star, you know, the other pieces that were left did, you know, none of them went on to improve. They all kind of went down. So you would have been stuck with the star, nothing else. And the star was going to leave you then in free agency soon afterwards.
Yeah. And just adding to that, I mean, we sort of see seeing that situation play out again all these years later with the whole Anthony Davis piece. Now, probably not as vehemently, because Anthony Davis was never really a realistic target and he was not necessarily mentioned or linked to the Bulls, but it would have been the same situation where, again, we've heard maybe among the fan base, but even in the media as well, where people were wondering why the Bulls weren't more active in chasing a player like Anthony Davis and putting together a package of, you know, maybe Lauri Markkanen and Wendell Carter Jr. or whatever the package needed to be to get a player like Davis. And to Doug's exact point is, a player like Davis is wanting to get out of somewhere like New Orleans because he doesn't necessarily have the help. Same thing, you can go back to Kevin Garnett and Kobe Bryant all those years earlier, that when you sort of trade the necessary pieces to get in a player like Davis or Kobe or whoever it may be, you're not necessarily bringing them to a better situation. You're just literally moving them to a different city with the same problems. So it's funny how a lot of these sort of circumstances that we're talking about now sort of rear their heads all these years later, because it's almost the same situation that we're sort of seeing with Anthony Davis at this point with the Chicago Bulls, and why the Bulls maybe were hesitant to give up key valuable pieces of their rebuild, and comparing that to what we're sort of talking about now, like 10, 15 years earlier. It's a bit funny when you think about it in hindsight.
I want to get to one other trade here, the Ben Wallace trade. Other than shedding that contract, did really trading him to Cleveland for Drew Gooden and Larry Hughes make a lot of sense? And I'll start with you, Doug.
Clearly nothing meaningful came of it. I mean, Larry Hughes was awful. He had there was that website, Hey Larry, Larry Hughes, stop taking so many bad shots, .com, which was, you know, a fun outcome of getting to look at that website once Larry Hughes was on our roster. I think it was a good gamble. I mean, Hughes was younger. You had some hope he could maybe rehab or at least be a defensive player, but it ultimately made no difference. It was just trash for trash.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Like, it's almost, do we even bother grading this specific deal? Because to Doug's point, it was a trash for trash deal. We're getting rid of our trash. We had to take trash to get rid of our trash. So it was a mess of a trade. Nothing that ultimately mattered that much. But that was the cost of doing business. And you weren't going to get anything back or return for Ben Wallace at that point, who was 33, 34 years of age, still earning pretty big dollars in those times, I suppose. He had 2 years, 30 years. $30 million still on his deal, somewhere in that vicinity left. So for a trash contract like Ben Wallace at that point, you were only getting back trash, and that's ultimately what the Bulls got back.
I think the one other trade you should talk about, which I mentioned earlier, was the draft pick trade of trading to get Lou Aldang. And I think that pick was unprotected in 2005. That was a big risk, and I know we kind of covered it in the draft, but that ultimately also ended up being a truly exceptional trade that the Bulls made.
This is true. Like, and I put that as part of the draft, just because some of those draft day deals, I kind of include that as sort of its own little package. But, you know, that certainly was a big trade. And, you know, Lou Aldang ended up being a valuable piece for the Bulls for almost 9-10 years.
Yeah, another one to mention as well, and my memory on this one is foggy, so I'm sort of... I don't know if I want to head down this path because I don't have all the facts in front of me, and my recollection may be faded, but I think the Tyson Chandler one as well was kind of interesting because ultimately it became Ben Wallace, and Tyson Chandler was out of here because they had that sort of not just Ben Wallace, but obviously what they did in the draft too. But obviously what we saw Tyson Chandler become, and the fact that he was a piece from that Krause era that didn't necessarily work in the Paxson era. Obviously, Paxson was pretty keen to get rid of the players from that Krause era, but I think that'll be ultimately one of those what-if situations as well, where maybe if had things played out a little bit differently, whether Tyson Chandler could have been had and remained in Chicago. Obviously, it's not that big of a deal because of what Joakim Noah ended up becoming for the Bulls a year later on. So I don't know if we want to spend any time focusing on that one, but it was kind of a wasted opportunity too because the Bulls didn't necessarily do much with PJ Brown and certainly J.R. Smith easily either.
And I think this is actually we can spend a little time talking about this one because it is important to grade because you did get PJ Brown, who you got one good season out of, solid season. But even taking into account that deal also included J.R. Smith, who you later flipped to the Denver Nuggets for Howard Eisley and two 2007 second round picks. So you lost Tyson Chandler, who morphed into a valuable player after that. And then you also didn't keep J.R. Smith, who ended up becoming a pretty solid player in the league. Doug, you had any thoughts about that trade?
You know, for me, I guess the main thing I would say about the Tyson trade is kind of to Mark's point, there's really no way you could see Tyson doing anything meaningful for the Bulls because of Wallace. He wasn't going to get playing time. He wasn't a guy who could play next to Wallace. He wasn't a guy who could play next to Noah. He wasn't a better player than Noah going forward. So it's hard to see how he could have rebuilt his value with Chicago. I really wanted the Bulls to keep J.R. Smith because I thought that was a high upside type of guy to have on your roster. He was a very athletic wing who could potentially shoot. That didn't work out. They didn't want his attitude. And I think that gets back to the kind of character traits that Mark alluded to that John Paxson held. And just thought this guy's not going to fit. And at the moment, it felt like the guard rotation was really crowded and they had high expectations for Thabo Sefolosha. And, you know, it turned out to be ridiculously not crowded in retrospect. And J.R. Smith would have been a tremendous fit. And it's funny, had we kept Smith, I think ultimately we would have felt a million times better about that Tyson trade than we do now. But it's hard to see where Tyson would have got the minutes to rebuild his value had he stayed. And I don't think it would have been a good long-term piece, but it would have been nice if they could have maybe traded him if he had the opportunity to rebuild value at a higher point. I mean, they really traded him at his low value, but it's hard to see how waiting would have raised his value here.
Okay, so on a scale of 1 to 5, guys, how would you rate the trades during this portion of the Garpax era? And I'll start with you, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, this is tough. There's so many factors in this one because you've got the perceived trades that may or may not have been. Again, it depends how strong you want to weight these. And maybe, Matt, you're a little bit different to me in the sense that I, you know, going star hunting and trading for those stars, it only makes sense for me in certain occasions. And for Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett and Pau Gasol at the time, I was never enamored with him based on who it would have taken to trade to get that player in, who would have left who would have left on the roster. So it almost depends how you weight those sort of factors. But for me, I guess that trade with the Knicks, specifically the Eddie Curry trade and what it returned for the Bulls and what it could have been, I weight that favorably. Obviously, the whole Ben Wallace situation, trading him out and the mess that it became. I mean, watching Drew Gooden and Larry Hughes and those sorts of players, that was a tough time being a Bulls fan. I mean, they were tough players to watch. But I think all in all, I'll probably maybe like a 2.5, 2.25. Let's go 2.25 because it was pretty tough in those later years.
I that's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Why do we disagree on something?
Okay, you had perhaps the best trade in franchise history in one of the best trades I can think of in the NBA. Like maybe not top 10 all time, but like literally probably like a top 20 trade all time in your favor, and you're gonna give them a 2.5 for the era.
Well, I mean, you have to think about who those picks became as well. So I'm weighting that into the
criteria as well. If ultimately a bad contract for a guy who got MVP shares, was a multi-time All-Star player. I mean,
yeah,
I know. Amazing trade.
And I think it's my guy in the draft. So
it's a trade. I just don't think you also look at the value you got from the trade, not necessarily how you use the value. So to get a number 2 and number 9 pick for Curry was just unbelievable. So one amazing trade there. The trade to get Luol Deng was also an amazing trade, a very high risk trade that ended up working out. I don't see what trades you don't like from this era. Even the trade of Ben Wallace, even though it was like a trash for trash trade, you traded old trash that was clearly going to be useless for younger trash that at least had some chance of working out. And then Drew Gooden ended up being at least a somewhat useful piece for the Chicago Bulls as well, and was clearly a good trade. I mean, I just think like these were all like pretty good trades. There's no bad trades that happened in this era. I'm going like straight 5. This was an amazing trade era.
No, so I completely disagree. I didn't factor Deng into this because we talked about him in the draft piece. So
still a
trade. Technically,
it's a trade.
It was still a trade. It was technically still a trade. So you're right
not
in that.
Technically, it was a trade. It's
I know, but
we can't
loop it into this section as well. Is my point.
I'm gonna disqualify the Deng trade, Doug. So because I'm gonna count that as a draft acquisition. So
it's both. It was a good draft pick by taking Deng with the number 7 pick, and it was a good trade. Trading what ends up being number 21 in 2005 for number 7 in 2004. They're two separate things. Both of them were executed outstandingly. Still straight 5.
All right. You know what? You're lucky you're the podfather. I'll give this to you.
I appreciate it, Matt.
All right. We'll let you...
Well, if we're factoring in Deng, I'll bump mine up to the 3 then.
How do you still not give them so much credit? Like, what is the bad thing that happened? Like, you agreed that the Curry trade, earlier you said they owned the Knicks in
they
these
did.
Two trades. So they owned them in these other trades. Like, is there any trade you didn't like in this era? Like, what trade do you think was a bad trade that you would have not have done?
Well, like I said, it depends how you want to weight the non-trades, I suppose, into this conversation. If we're just talking about moves definitely made, then it's a different conversation. But
you also didn't buy the winning lottery numbers today. Yeah, you can't factor in non-moves. Like,
it's slightly different.
Even you said, like, if you made those trades, you had to give up way too much. You'd have nothing left.
I definitely said that, but I mean, ultimately, you get back a star player, and who knows where the team sort of complexion goes from there. So it depends how you want to weight these things. But I didn't like the Tyson Chandler trade. I didn't necessarily like the J.R. Smith thing. There was a few other trades that were there on the margins. The whole Ben Wallace, like you said, was trading mess for mess. So I'm not going to rate that favorably because, like, I hated watching Drew Gooden and Larry Hughes. They were bad players. So it ultimately depends how you weight these things, but. If we're factoring Deng into it, yes, it was a trade. It wasn't just technically a trade. I'll take that back. But, I mean, I didn't include that in my initial summation of it. But, like, if we're including Deng, again, I'll bump it up to a 3 because I don't think this was a win for the Bulls throughout this era.
I'm ecstatic that I got you from 2.5 to 3. I'm going to count that as a personal victory.
This is how we negotiate.
I'll bump myself down to 4.5 so it ends up being even. We don't actually shift the score.
Fair enough.
Okay, so just to recap everything for the listeners out there, Mark's changing his to a 3. Doug, are you still at a 5?
I think Mark is right. I think the Tyson Chandler trade, and maybe not even the Chandler trade, which I think makes sense, but the giving up on J.R. Smith when he clearly was something that we need is enough for me to have to deduct at least a half point. So I'm gonna go down to 4.5. I just love that Eddie Curry trade so much. I like, to me, that's just like a 4 by itself.
Well, we already established that I'm the meatball in the bunch, so I'm gonna go with a 2.5, and I'm not even gonna really have to explain myself here. just to recap again, Doug with a 4.5 out of 5, Mark with a 3 out of 5, and all right, you know what? I'm gonna change mine to a 3 out of 5. I gotta give him credit for those two trades. All right, let's get to the coaching decisions. Unlike some executives who clean house upon their arrival, John Paxson decided to keep Bill Cartwright on as head coach. Cartwright, who had served as head coach for 2 seasons, oversaw a 30-win campaign in 2003. While 30 wins isn't really impressive, prior to that year, the franchise had been through 3 seasons where they only won 17, 15, and 21 games respectively. Not to mention, Paxson and Cartwright were teammates on the Bulls from 1989 to 1994, both serving as key role players during the team's first three-peat, so it was understandable why Cartwright got a fair shake under new leadership. However, after a 4-10 start, the Bulls fired Cartwright. Instead of appointing an interim coach for the rest of the season, Paxson acted swiftly. Just days later, he hired former Suns coach Scott Skiles as the Bulls' new head coach. While the team only won 19 more games the rest of the year, Skiles brought a no-nonsense attitude to a young ball club, and he was vital in helping Paxson weed out those who weren't worth keeping. While players like Eddie Curry and Tyson Chandler never really warmed up to Skiles, he seemed to connect with Kirk Heinrich, Ben Gordon, and Luol Deng. With Skiles at the helm, the Bulls reached the postseason for 3 straight seasons, from 2005 to 2007. They also were one of the best defensive teams in the league, finishing in the top 10 in defensive rating each of those years. Unfortunately for Paxson and company, what plagued Skiles and Phoenix started to rear its ugly head in Chicago. Skiles had a reputation for burning out and wearing thin on his players. The start of the 2008 season, the Bulls got off to a rocky start, and the team never really regained its form from the previous year. Seeing the relationship sour to the point of no return, Paxson fired Skiles on Christmas Eve 2007 after a 9-16 start. The Bulls named Jim Boylan, again B-O-Y-L-A-N, as interim coach for the rest of the year, but it didn't matter. The team finished the year with 33 wins, and Paxson went into the following offseason to find his next head coach. All right, so I'm curious what you guys think, and I'll start with you, Mark. Do you think John Paxson wanted Scott Skiles from the start, but didn't want to disrespect Bill Cartwright, his former teammate?
It's hard to say from the outside. Like, I don't know the answer to that question. I could speculate on the answer to that question. I would say Scott Skiles is the type of coach that aligns exactly with what Paxson would typically like. I mean, if we think about who Paxson was as a player, who he's been as an executive, Scott Skiles made complete sense. So I could mount an argument that, yes, Paxson wanted Scott Skiles as his head coach, but at the same time, to your point, he probably didn't necessarily want to disrespect a former teammate. And coming in as an executive in one of your first decisions, having to be to get rid of your, you know, one of your ex-teammates from that coaching position, I definitely wouldn't want to be in that position if I was Paxson, making those sorts of decisions and putting relationships on the line. I think we underrate that whole aspect in terms of, you know, executives and what they need to do, and not just executives, from the player side as well. So I don't know, can it be both? Can it be a combination of both? I think that's probably the right answer.
I agree with Mark largely, and I think the only thing I would add, and I think it is hard to say, but the only thing I would really add about it is I think Paxson had just come in. It's his first time being a general manager. And, you know, I don't think he wanted to come in and make huge waves. He's still probably learning, you know, how to manage some of his personal relationships. I think he wanted to see Cartwright as a coach in person first and see how things went before he made that decision. I think he felt he probably owed that to Cartwright. I don't know if for sure he had Skiles on his short list, like in the middle of June, and was like, oh, yeah, we're going to get this guy if things don't work out, or if he just saw how the team was functioning under Cartwright after a brief period of time and said, yeah, this just isn't this just isn't what we need. We got to go another direction.
It was very interesting because right after they fired Cartwright, it was almost like a week turnaround when Skiles came on. So I think there's something to what you said about that short list that he might have just had in mind. So Skiles was 165 and 172 as head coach of the Bulls, not including the playoffs, but had three straight seasons of getting to the postseason from 05 to 07. Starting with you, Doug, how would you define that short tenure for Scott Skiles?
I mean, I think it was pretty successful. It was a really fun era in 2004-05. That's still probably one of my favorite all-time seasons as a Bulls fan, and I think you'll actually get that from a lot of different Bulls fans. He clearly had his problems, too. He broke Tyson Chandler. I mean, completely. Even Chandler spoke about it, so definitely had his flaws, and he clearly wore out his welcome. Either burnt out himself or his players got so burnt out that they tuned him out. It's hard to say exactly which, but I think it was still overall it was a good change based on what you had seen for so long. I mean, he helped breathe life into a lifeless organization. He was part of the thing that made that happen, and those players really had their best years under Skiles. I mean, like, it's not like those guys went and did a whole bunch of amazing things later. I mean, those guys all pretty much had their best career year under Scott Skiles as coach.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything that Doug noted there. And I think with any conversation, there's multiple layers. There's so much context to sort of digest. But the word that really jumps out at me when I think about Scott Skiles and his sort of tenure as coach is the word necessary. I think we talked about the Krause era and how bad that was, and you can sort of maybe label John Paxson this too in terms of being necessary, but it was a necessary change that this franchise really needed. So whilst it was short and whilst he burnt out the players, it didn't last as long as maybe what we all had hoped it would. I think Scott Skiles was a necessary coach for this team at that necessary point in time. So, yeah, it didn't last long. It probably was never going to last long based on how hard he went about it. But I think it was the kind of coach this team needed at that point in time.
Can we also just talk for just a brief second about how freaking amazing Scott Skiles was with the media? Like,
oh my God.
Just such a sarcastic, like, just crazy. I mean, it was just, and I'll tell you one personal story. My favorite quote ever was like, "How can Eddie Curry rebound
love
better?"
This
and
one.
He's just like, "Jump." That's it. So one time, this is after Scott Skiles was, I think he was coaching the Bucks. Was that where he went? After the Bulls, I think. And I met Las Vegas Summer League. And I don't know if you've ever been to Las Vegas Summer League, but if you just go as a fan, you can sit in the stands and all the scouts and team execs and all these other people are just sitting in the stands. And I don't know if they've changed it up because now it's maybe a little more popular. And they had kind of like this roped off section only for like media people, but pretty much like people just sat everywhere. So like Scott Skiles is like sitting in the stands, and I wanted to go talk to him about the Bulls because, you know, I'm just like, oh, this will be cool. I'll go talk with Scott Skiles. And I start like walking up there, and he's kind of there like sort of by himself. And I've got like my media credential pass like on my shoulder, and he like just looks at me walking towards him. And he just like glares at me, and I just like turned around and walked away. Like it just gave me this look of like, there is no way I am saying a word to you. Just like this communicator, all the look, and I'm like, nope, this is not going to go well. And I just left.
Well, I mean, that's a guy who used to pick fights with Shaq in practice. So he's a tough nosed guy. So I want to actually ask this question too, and I'll start with you, Mark, on this one. Did Skiles burn out naturally, or do you think that there were some underlying factors with the players or Pax?
Well, I think this is an interesting question because I think when we think about Gar Pax and their era, not just in this tenure, but just throughout their 17, 18 years with the team, whatever it is at this point, 16 years, I think something that goes under the radar is their handling of interpersonal relationships, which is definitely could have been better. I think that's something that you can't necessarily grade like you can with a transaction, because for us, at least from our vantage point, we don't necessarily know all the facts involved. So I want to preface that just generally, and because I think it's the point that gets underrated or overlooked when we talk about Gar Pax more generally. But for this specific situation, bringing it back to here to Skiles, I think there was clearly issues between him and Paxson, whether there were issues that were happening on the court, how he was treating players, how he was burning himself out, and as well as the team out. I don't obviously know the answer to those things, and we probably can never know the answer to those things based on our vantage point. But based on how we saw Skiles I guess how his coaching career sort of progressed in Milwaukee, but also in Orlando as well. It was sort of a similar situation. So I kind of lean towards more the way things went with Skiles here in Chicago, and obviously how we saw them sort of transpire in Milwaukee and Orlando, that it was probably always going to come to this point based on who Skiles was as a personality. I don't know what percentage we can sort of attribute management to the fall down with Skiles. Maybe they deserve a portion of the blame. I don't know how we split that up, but like I said, based on how things went for Skiles in Orlando and Milwaukee, it probably was always headed this way.
Yeah, I would. I actually don't know that I would think there was maybe something between Skiles and Paxson. You know, I think Skiles just burnt out. I just think he pushed too hard. He you know, just tried to push players too hard, and I just think he burnt out. And everything about his career afterwards, you know, to me seems to kind of confirm that. And maybe I just don't see a whole lot more to it than that. I think to me, this one is pretty straightforward. This was just a guy who is not meant to coach for any long period of time. Just too fiery, too fired up, pushes guys too hard.
And before I wrap this part up, anyone got thoughts on the original Jim Boylan, Boylan? If not, we could just give him a moment of silence and move on.
Yeah, no good thoughts.
My thought is only the laugh.
Okay. Well, we'll move on then. Let's grade then, I guess, the major hirings and firings. There's only really one of them. On a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate the coaching decisions from this period? Doug, I'll start with you.
I'll go 3.5. I think Skiles, to Mark's point, I think he had a great word, necessary. I think he set the tone, got the most out of these players that we ever saw them, almost talking myself into a 4, but the quick burnout and, you know, lack of follow-up plan that was meaningful afterwards, and the fact that they extended him, even though it seemed like this is a guy who's going to burn out, like they didn't have to extend him. You know, they actually, you know, kind of made a mistake there. I'm going to keep it around 3.5.
Yeah, my natural inclination was to go the 3 again, but I think given the amount of success, and obviously the success wasn't ultimately in terms of championships or even Eastern Conference final appearance, it was a successful period of Bulls basketball based on where they had sort of come out of with the Krause era. So it was short-lived. Skiles, in a lot of ways, represented this era, and his tenure did that, I suppose. But I think he was a good coach for the team at the time. Like I said, it was a necessary change, and what he did here was good. It ended abruptly. It didn't end the way that we all hoped it would, but his coaching career mimicked this team in a lot of ways. So I'll probably give it maybe a 3.25. I'm sticking to that theme, the whole 2 point. I'm going to make this difficult for you, Matt, in terms of adding it up later on.
I'm adding it now. So I'm actually going to give this a 4. And the reason I'm giving it a 4 is I'm giving Paxson credit for identifying his coach pretty swiftly. So when he saw that things were struggling under Cartwright, he made that move. He had the coach that he wanted in mind, and he hired the guy. So I give him big props for that. And I do think that Skiles really did help set the tone for everything. All right, so I'm going to tally this up right now. So, Doug, you rated Gar Paxson in this era, taking into account the drafts, free agency signings and re-signings, trades, and coaching decisions. You ended with a 15.25 out of 20. You had the highest score. Mark, you had a 12.75 out of 20, and I had a 13.75 out of 20. So not too bad. I think, you know, we all went 2.75 on the free agency signings. I think we all kind of agreed on that. I think that kind of brought down everybody's score. Before I let you guys go, I want to just ask a quick question to conclude this episode. How would you best summarize this period from 2003, in the offseason of 2003, through the 2008 regular season? I'll start with you, Mark.
Well, I mean, just thinking about what the grading that I gave him, it ultimately works out to be like 64, 65%, something like that. And I don't want to necessarily just hinge my final comments on that, but in a lot of ways it sort of relates to it, I guess, that when you sort of grade it all out, maybe it's a B-C sort of grade, because there were some high moments and there were some low moments. But ultimately, I do remember this fondly because of, like I mentioned before, what it sort of preceded or what it came after, the fact that the Krause era was so bad that it sort of enabled me to look at this era of Bulls basketball quite fondly. And Look, I'd be lying if I would say those couple playoff runs that this team had, particularly in 2007, they were high times for us post the Jordan era. I mean, we hadn't been to the playoffs in so long that even just getting back there and having a scrappy team that won a round or at least could compete in the playoffs, that was fun to watch, and it reinvigorated the fan base. And I can't say city because I'm not necessarily there, but based in Melbourne in Australia, it reinvigorated me as a Bulls fan. So I can't only imagine what it did for those people in Chicago. So I remember this era fondly because of who it was, who the players were sort of representing the team at that point, where we had come from, and the fact that they were able to get us back to some sort of level of respectability, which was nice.
Yeah, and I think I would maybe call the era a B. And I think there's a good way to look at this is, so when you're rebuilding a team, and all teams, I think basketball is very cyclical. And I think that's one of the reasons why people get so frustrated with it is there are just down and up cycles. And when you're in a down cycle, you collect talent, your talent kind of comes together. And then you start towards this up cycle. And then the most likely scenario in that up cycle is your talent is not good enough to contend for a title. And then you start a down cycle again. And if you're lucky, you have that super rare player who can bring you up to that higher level. And so this was a cycle where clearly the talent was not good enough, you know, to compete for a title and do anything meaningful. The Bulls took their best swing by adding the best guy they could in Ben Wallace. And you had this brief glimmer of kind of like, hey, we got a puncher's chance at winning a title, even though you didn't even really think it was super likely. But that coming from the Krause era, to get to a point where at the beginning of a season, you said to yourself, wow, if things go well, we could win the title. Like, that's just such a massive shift from the complete laughing stock that they were for so long. It was a fun era. You know, in retrospect, you look at those players and you know it just wasn't enough talent to really ever to amount to a whole lot more than it ended up amounting to. But it was just such a shift from what came before that it was a very fun time to be a Bulls fan, and something I really enjoyed.
Yeah, and just to add to that, if I can, Matt, I mean, this team really taught me the fact that it isn't just about winning titles, because if that's all you're interested in as a fan, then you're probably never going to be happy. I mean, we're somewhat... we're a bit lucky being Chicago Bulls fans based on what happened in the 90s. But, I mean, for other fans of other teams that may not have won a title, what do they have to necessarily root for? And I think, again, it's a cliche, but the journey is kind of important in itself, and it can be just as fun, because I think this team taught me that they were never going to be a title team, as, or at least we realistically came to the point that we didn't think they were going to be a title team, as sort of Doug alluded to. But it ultimately didn't matter, because, I mean, we still look back and we're still talking about this team all these years later on. It's almost 20 years ago at this point. I mean, 15 years ago. So we still look back on it fondly because of what it sort of meant for us as fans. And you can still look back on an era of basketball, even though it ultimately didn't relate to or reward the team with a title. It still means something. And I think you can make that case for the Thibodeau era post Derrick Rose, that they were to me some of the fondest memories as well, even though that team had no chance of winning a title. I think there's still value to be had as a fan watching teams at least go out there and maximize what they could be, and that's ultimately what this team did.
You know, guys, I really appreciate you coming on and grading this portion of the Garpacks era with me, so thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Thanks to Doug for putting up with me as well. It was great to hear from you, Doug. But yeah, it was fun to talk about the old days and one of the more fun teams that we've had an opportunity to root for. Can we go back?
Thank you for listening to the Rebuildable Podcast. Be sure to check out more episodes on Google Play, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Rebuildable.com.